accession number 23441, real one.
Actually, for somebody, monthly articles about the state of the world in which he.
Mr. Wildman, real one, where were you born, please?
Range Park, Wimbledon, London.
Which year was this?
1920.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Raines Park?
Well, actually, my schooling at the start, I was a sickly boy. I did start at Raines Park. But then in 1930, we moved here to Tolworth. So my den was carried on here in the Tolworth area. But unfortunately, was unable to finish my education properly because my father had a very, very terrible accident, and it just meant to say that you had to go to work to help the family out. He was terribly crippled.
In which industry was that?
Well, at the moment, at the time, he was out of work because his father had closed down the shop they were working on in London, and he was doing part-time work on his way home from a part-time job he was doing when he was hit by a driver, a drunken driver, who smashed him up completely.
So how old were you when you started work?
I was 15 when I started work.
What job were you doing?
I started work in a factory. But then a family friend came in one day and said, how would you like to earn sixpence an hour, which in those days was quite a lot of money for a young boy. He said, I'll teach you the trade. So I went into it and started in the building trade in ceramic tiling, in mosaics, etc., which I carried on until such time as, of course, I joined the service.
Had you joined any military organisation pre-war, like the Territorial Army?
The nearest I got to joining the Territorial Army is that one of my brothers was in East Surrey's Territorial Regiment, the 5th Battalion East Surrey's, and he thought it might be a good idea for me to come along and join the band. But it didn't last very long because, I don't know why, I think I found other things to do, I don't know quite what. But he did stay in with the East Surreys, which transferred to artillery in the end. And then my other brother, who joined in the 3rd Carbineers, which was my father's old regiment when it was known as the 3rd Dragoon Guards out in South Africa, my brother joined them. And then he transferred from them to the 13th, 18th. But unfortunately, he was killed in action in 1940 during a rearguard action fought by the regiment at Dunkirk. So, both my other brother, who had joined the 10th Royal Hussars, and myself, both applied and joined the 13th 18th. So it made three brothers who served in the 13th 18th. But so Jack, unfortunately, was killed in 1940.
Do you remember Neville Chamberlain declaring war on Germany?
Oh yes, I remember that, sitting here, not in this room, because in the room on the Kingston Bypass, listening to it. Because already by that time, Jack had come home from India not long before the regiment, was already recalled to service. You know, rejoined the regiment. He was doing some other job in London. And of course he was recalled to the regiment, and the chap in the bin of the East Surrey's artillery, he was already called up for service. So my mother was terribly worried, the two called up straight away, or into service straight away.
How did you feel about the news that war had been declared?
How did I feel? Well, knowing what war was all about, even in those days, I wasn't very happy about it.
Did the war affect you at first, personally?
Well, the only way it did affect me is that I was working for this chap who offered me this job. He was a territorial. He got called up for service. And I took over his contract and started working on contract in the building trade for a short period of time until such times I got called up.
Were you in any early bombing of England by the German Air Force?
Well, this so often happens, the soldier was better off than the civilian in that case.
I heard a lot.
You heard a lot, I know. No, didn't really come across any to see, but then I was in the service, and, you know, early in the 1940, I was called up for service, and we went down to Taunton Manor Camp in the artillery unit. And because that's so isolated down there, we just heard about the war from any strange source, because you didn't really see it yourself.
What was your training like at Taunton?
Well, because of my medical condition, that's why I didn't get to the 18th straight away. I was transferred to an artillery unit of Air Defence Great Britain and started training as a searchlight operator.
What was your medical condition?
I was a B1 or 2. They wouldn't accept me into the Hussars. And I started training there and getting on quite well. In fact, nearly finished training when Dunkirk started. And we were taken off training and we started then training as infantry. Well, good with the business difference, it's another matter. We've never done any training in that way at all.
Well, what medical problems did you have to...
Physique, more than anything else.
The what?
Physique, size. I did have other problems, but I don't really know what they based it on.
So how tall were you?
About 5'10".
And how much did you wear?
Oh, I don't know, offhand. I was quite lightweight.
So you started training on searchlights, and
yeah.
Then they transferred you to infantry.
And they made us into an infantry unit, and we finished up as the armed guard to a factory up in Coventry.
What was the name of this unit? Or number?
I think it was 391, but I couldn't remember that.
391 what?
Searchlight battery. But I can't really remember to be sure, because we moved around quite a bit. I mean, they called it a searchlight battery, but we had nothing to do with searchlights.
Did they just have men in the searchlight battery at that time, or did they have women as well?
Well, they were only men at that time. Excuse me. But... So in the end, we were taken out off of that duties. Our duties as a guard was taken over by Pioneer Corps Company. We moved to Blackdown, you know, deep cut area, where we got split up, and a group of us were sent up to Coventry, from Coventry, up to Scotland to reform a new training regiment outside Truin in Scotland, where I must admit the battery sergeant major, who turned out to be the RSM of the new regiment, gave us the top treatment. We got all the best jobs. We were in his battery, so we got the best jobs when we got up there. I must have had the cushiest job in the army up there.
What was that?
I was an administrative battery storeman. But when he saw my store, in one long wall was loads and loads of kit bags. And on the bottom of those kit bags was Mary Hill, Bellini, Shepton Mallet, absent, deserted. Nearly all my men in my battery, in my troop, rode the bad boys of the army, deserters from all sorts. And they all finished having this one troop, and I was in charge of their equipment. So in fact, I had nothing to do. I said, because it's not job going. Until somebody suddenly realised that the ATS could do the job better than me. So I was switched back to training again. I got, and some of my training took part with what was then one of the most top secret equipment of the Air Defence Unit of England, called SLC, Searchlight Control. This was a radar operation system that didn't work on sound, it worked on mass, volume. So you picked up a plane, you weren't listening to the sound, you just picked up the sound.
So this was searchlight control work?
Searchlight control. And then I got posted from there to a service station for experimental reasons, to test out this equipment on the searchlight control. And we did a fair bit of search of work with this until the day came when we were told we would go into actual operation.
Where were you at this time?
On the east coast of Yorkshire.
Whereabouts?
Bridlington, Foston, Beeford, and that sort of area.
And you say you then went into operation?
Yes, we said we would go into operation. And the first week we went into operation, a single German plane, what it was doing, why it was there, we don't know. But you know, you had the big filer radar stations that recorded, sent back to us that there was a plane about 20 miles off the coast coming towards us. So we picked him up and he came in, and for some reason he switched his engines off. I suppose his idea was he was going to glide in for some reason or the other. Because it didn't make any difference to us. Because we didn't go on sound, we were going on the mass of the plane. And at a given signal, we were told to illuminate. And we pressed the button, because we were the control vehicle. We pressed the button, and we got two other searchlights connected with ours, worked together by a computer system of some sort that they had in those days. And when we pressed the button, these three lights all hit, and there was this plane gliding in right in the middle of where all three lights. And then we got the order to switch off the lights immediately, because the night fighter had already come up. We'd given ideas of where the rough position where the plane was, and we were told to switch off the lights, which we did do. And the next thing, well, I was taking height. I was working on height on this machine. And also, I was just going down and down and down, and nobody else was moving. They were just keeping the same distance, and I was going down. Then in the morning, the Air Force pilot came in and said that when we switched off the lights, he was within 300 yards of the plane, German plane. The German plane had no idea he was right there behind him. And so, because what I was seeing was him going down into the sea.
So he shot him down?
The pilot shot him down.
Was it a German bomber?
Nobody knows. I never did hear. Why it was coming in, what it was doing, whether it was going to be a spy plane or something like that, we don't know. Just a single plane.
Seems a bit odd that he switched off his engine.
Well, his idea was to glide in over the coast. Because we picked him up about 12 miles off the coast.
Usually they keep the engines going, they dive in and out, don't they?
It might have been carrying some spy or something, I don't know.
So, what was the name and number of this unit you were working for?
Oh, there again, I can't remember the number offhand. It was 497, I think. But I don't really know, quite honest. It was a Yorkshire Territorial Regiment.
Was this known as a searchlight battery as well?
It was a searchlight battery.
What do you think it was, 49?
I really can't say it. I couldn't guarantee that number. But then they realised that as the system had proved itself, the ATS girls who'd been learning the equipment then took over from us. And all us men had to go through a medical grading because they were going to transfer the regiment from searchlights to Bofa guns. So we switched from searchlights to Bofa guns. But you had to pass a medical grade to get an A grade before you could transfer over. And I managed to get an A grade. And the moment I got an A grade, I banged in my application to join the 13th 18th.
You put in an application for it?
Yeah. Which was, well, first of all, the battery commander turned me down, but in the end, he relented and let me go. So I did finally join the 30th 18th.
So this was for family reasons?
Family reasons. You know, my brother, well, you can tell what it was like, because the first day I walked into the regiment areas up in Skipton, I heard a big voice shout to me, "Come over here, soldier." And it turned out to be Duffy Hine, the RSM of the regiment. Another little bit of conversation, he asked me where I was going. I said I was going down to regiment headquarters to find out where I'd been billeted. And his answer was, "You silly little man. You know full well you're not going to regimental headquarters, you're going to B Squadron, your brother's in B Squadron, your other brother's in B Squadron, you're going into B Squadron." And that was Duffy, so sent me off straight down to B Squadron.
You said this was in Skipton?
In Skipton, hmm.
Can you tell me about what happened to you once you joined the unit?
Once I joined the 3/8. Well, as soon as I joined as a... when I was in the 54 training regiment, I got sent on a course, fitters course. And I was 16 weeks on that course, and then 6 weeks on advanced course after that. So when I joined the regiment in body, I was already in the regiment in name, in number, in paper. When I joined in body, I joined as a... fitter 3AFV. I was a fitter responsible for the armoured fighting vehicles within the regiment. So that was my job from then on, as a fitter within B Squadron. Keeping the squadron running, sort of thing.
What kind of equipment did they have?
Well, it was a Carter training regiment. I don't know if you know what I mean by Carter training regiment, although one of the oldest regiments in the army, but still just doing Carter training. So most of the equipment was different types of cruisers. They had the Mark IV, then they had the Covenanter and the Crusader cruiser tanks.
What did you think of the tanks that you were working on?
Well, shall we say, not having a lot of knowledge of tanks as such, they seemed to be good, but subsequently discovered they weren't quite as good as we thought. But they were good. The Covenanter was very good, I thought. Particularly when you played about with the carburetors that we did do, which we weren't supposed to, and got them up to about 60 or 70 miles an hour across down the roads, which was very illegal.
What happened to you next?
Well, we carried on with this training in the Skipton area for quite a while as a Carter training regiment, and all of a sudden we were removed from that duties, and we started finding that there was a sort out of men, some of the old India men, many been in the regiment out in India and places like that, were being posted away. And we're getting new bods in. Now, by now, we're coming into 1942. And we were told about the middle of 1942 that we would be forming with the 47th Dragoon Guards a new brigade. and we'll be transferred to a certain division. We will be, the two regiments were in the cinema up in Keighley, and then they told us, our colonel said, I will now introduce you to your new divisional commander. And as soon as you walked onto the platform, a big groan went up from the cinema. Oh, he says, I see a lot of you know about me. Yes, you are coming to the 79th. You're going to be one of the funnies from now on. And I suspect you've heard of the funnies.
Yes, I have, but could you tell me about it, please?
Well, the funnies, the 79th Army, it was a secret army, armoured regiment of the British Army, and in it was all the secret equipment that one would find, of all sorts. So many strange things, beehives and snakes and all that sort of thing. Lots of strange things. And I know one chap, when Percy Hobart said that you two regiments have been picked for special duty, in some months' time you'll find out, you'll see what it is. It says, I tell you now that you two regiments will lead the assault onto the continent of Europe. So one bright spark got up and said, but sir, tanks have never been first ashore. He said, I know that, you're going to be the first. I said, how are we going to do that? He said, that is something you're going to find out for the next few months. But I warn you now, you're going to work bloody hard. He said, I'll work you and work you too. And I know that the Brigadier Prior Palmer is taking you over, will back me on this. And so that was it. We started our training from then on. That was by now, of course, 1943 has been well underway. And we started our training up in, well, we moved down to Wickham Market first, where we began to get new equipment. We got Sherman tanks and Valentines. And we couldn't understand why Valentines and Shermans, because they're two completely different type of tanks. Then I suddenly found myself sent to the Canadian Army Reinforcement Unit, down at Blackdown again, to spend a period of time with the Canadian Army, learning about Shermans, although they didn't have Shermans, they had the RAM. And I was learning about that as a fitter. And we still had these Valentines, which we still couldn't get the idea, until once we were sent up to Yarmouth, and we saw what it was. The Valentine was the learning vehicle to learn how to use the DDs. And so we used to go into this inland lake outside of Yarmouth and start learning how to use swimming tanks.
Can you describe what the training was like?
Hard. In and out of the water, time and time again. Not me personally, because I wasn't a tank crew, but my job was making sure that I had by then been given the DD equipment responsibility. I had to check that all the DD equipment was in good working order on the squadron. That was my, almost my main job, was to go with the crews and work on the equipment. And the crews knew full well, after a short bit of training, that it was absolutely essential that equipment was maintained properly, because their lives depended upon that maintenance. So between us, we really worked hard on the maintenance and checking every little bit, time and time and time again, that everything worked right. Particularly when we moved from Yarmouth down to Stokes Bay and then did sea training at the Solent.
What type of things did you specifically have to check? that were in working order?
Well, the main problem, biggest problem of the lot, was the props, the propellers at the back of the DD. Those props had to engage the dogs, and if you could move them more than a quarter of an inch off the dogs, then it was no good.
What's a dog?
Well, where the propellers came down into the... There's a driving gear here, and the propellers lock into it, and that's where the dogs were. But if you could pull that propeller off more than a quarter of an inch, you had to go check it all again, re-bleed and check, until you couldn't move it. Because if you went into the water pressure pushed the props away from the dogs, and you'd had it.
Was it easy to get it to lock into the dog?
Well, the way I had, what I was doing, well, once they were locked in and all the hydraulics were in action, is to get members of the crew to tie a rope round the propellers and stand back, and then I tell them to pull and pull and see how far they could move that propeller off the dogs. If it moved them more than a quarter of an inch, I think I used more hydraulic fluid there, enough to sink a battleship, the amount we used. And of course the lads, knowing that their life depended on it, worked too as well, and they worked hard. Those tanks, when we got ready for action in the end, were 150% right. Out of the 40 tanks we loaded on before D-Day, 31 through different reasons made the shore. 9 didn't make the shore. And of that 9, only one failed for an unexplained reason. That was an A squadron tank, wasn't a B squadron tank. All the others have a good reason why they failed to make the shore.
Any incidents that happened during the training on the Broads and at Stokes Bay?
Well, there were the worst incident wasn't on the Broads, it was in Fort George, because we did do a spell up in Fort George. I'd incidentally just done a spell at Inverary for combined operations training. But in Fort George, the crews, it was an A squadron tank, had just left the LCTs, were swimming into two Fort George, when a sudden squall came up and one tank went down and there was fatal fatalities on it. We did have another one down in Gosport, where because one of the drivers, or one driver had been a naughty boy and was doing 28 days detention, and the co-driver took over from him. But the co-driver, of course, didn't have had the experience of training that the driver had. And when they went into the water and started swimming home, and then he sat swimming back to shore, then he started saying, there's water in the bottom of the tank. And the crew commander said, well, you did close the dumps, didn't you? He said, the dumps? There's only one. And he said, there's two dump valves. You only closed one. So the water was coming in from the dump valve, coming back in underneath. So I was standing on the shore at the time, and suddenly saw this tank break off the echelon, it should be, and head for shore as quick as they could go, and we could see them going. They made it. And when we looked inside, it was a Valentine, when we looked inside, the co-driver, as he was then, was sitting with his neck up to, it would be the diesel, because the engine was still running. And he was water up to his neck.
Mr. Wildman, reel two.